You're listening to UK Health Radio, where health means more than the absence of illness. Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary show. I'm Hillary Burns, and each week we explore honest conversations about life, health, and whole person well-being through real stories of resilience, healing, and human connection. This is the Getting Real with Hillary show on UK Health Radio. Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary show. And today we have a very special guest who's talking about something very important. We have Dr. Lauren Hartman, who is a pediatrician and adolescent specialist and works with adolescents and parents. One of the things she talks about is eating disorders and trying to prevent them. So let's bring her to the studio. Welcome. Should we call you Lauren or Dr. Hartman?
You can call me Lauren.
Okay. Hi, Lauren.
It's really nice to be with you, Hillary. Hi.
Yes. So tell us where you were raised. I like to go back to the very beginning. Where were you raised? Did your brothers and sisters? How did you get into this?
I love this. Okay. So I was raised in New York in Long Island.
Okay.
And I have a older sister who I'm really close to. And I have parents who, like many parents, have struggled with just navigating diet culture. And I was raised in a household with a lot of diet foods and you know, fat-free, sugar-free this. And I know to my bones that my parents were really trying to do their best and trying to keep me safe in a fat-phobic world. Somehow I did not grow up with an eating disorder, despite kind of knowing like my mom's weight and having a scale in the bathroom at all times, but my sister did.
So were your parents struggling? Is that why they had all that stuff, or were they doing it for you?
I think it was just the culture, you know, of, yeah, I think a lot of households, especially in the 80s, like that was what, you know, I think they were just trying to do their best and thought fat was bad and diet foods were somehow healthier. And my sister had struggled with an eating disorder, still sort of does. And
were you heavy? Were you thin? Were you all thin or heavy? I mean, I hate to ask.
We were all thin. You know, that is something that I have to kind of name right out, is like, I have thin privilege and I've never had to navigate the world in a larger body. And I really don't know what that feels like, to have to face weight discrimination every day. But I know a lot.
Did your sister or you, she was thin, but just developed the eating disorder anyway? I mean, I know you don't have to be fat to develop one, but how was she?
I think she did not trust herself with food. So I think she felt, because there were a lot of rules in our house, or, you know, they weren't called rules, but like, this food is bad and this is something you don't eat, you know, these sorts of things. I think she felt she had to hide some of the foods that she wanted to eat and feel like she had no control around those foods, and then would feel a lot of shame around having eaten those foods. And then that would be followed up by restriction. And, you know, I will say, growing up, I don't think we didn't say she had a eating disorder. That wasn't something that was like talked about. My cousin, however, who I was really, really close with, we were like similar in age, she had a really serious eating disorder. And that was named. She was in and out of treatment programs for many, many years. And I saw the ways in which it just devastated her adolescence and her parents' adolescence, and that so much of her life had to be put on hold. So I saw that growing up and knew, like, oh, this is a terrible thing.
And was she okay? Did she end up okay?
You know, now she is a mom. She has kids. She, in many ways, has, for the most part, gotten through it. However, what's interesting in a like, gosh, just the fact that like our adolescence is such a critical window. She reached out to me a couple weeks ago and said, I just had my third fracture in the last 3 months. She's active, physically active, and said, why? I thought, now she's weight restored. She's like back on, back to a weight she probably should be. But it's the fact that, oh, she had this eating disorder when she was young and when her bones were developing. And we just don't get another window for that. And there's no real treatment for that except prevention, is the real thing.
Wow. Well, I was just listening. I was listening to a guy, I think it was over the summer. It was a program, and he's like, we all have eating disorders. His thing was about, it was called Wild Fit, and it was you were getting off of the foods that you were addicted to. So I don't know if you've heard of it, but it was, he talked a lot about the food industries, the dairy industry. I mean, it was pretty disgusting. But anyway, he said we probably all do. And I know I definitely used to binge, and I never purged, but I was a snake eater because you just couldn't eat certain stuff in front of my parents. Why are you eating that? You don't need it. They had stickers on the refrigerator. Boys don't make passes with girls with fat asses. And that was just normal. That was normal culture, right? But I remember, while I'm on a roll, I remember, I don't know, 10 years ago or 20 years ago, I don't know how many it was, what, and all of a sudden, because Twiggy was the person, you're probably younger, but Twiggy was the person. She was thin, and that was just the way it was supposed to be. But later, when like big butts came in, I'm like, when did this happen? Like, we could have like enjoyed our childhood, right? I could have, because there was shame about the hiding, and but it was almost like a game of not getting caught. I don't know if your sister was like that, but it was like there were certain things you didn't eat in front of people. I didn't want, if I was eating an ice cream, I would have to eat it, and you didn't want anyone to see you eating it, because that then they, I remember, okay, one more thing. I remember with a guy, we were in college, because I met him in college, and we're driving by or walking, I don't know, some girl who was probably a little heavy eating an ice cream cone. And I remember him, who I thought was a nice guy, yelling, oh, look at her eat, she does, look how fat she, you know what I mean? And I was like, oh my God. I remember that. So I remember thinking, oh, you can't eat these in public. And then my mom, still, who's 96 with dementia, we take her to the beach now, and if she sees a heavy girl, she'll be like, look at her. Oh my God. And I'm like, Mom, she's a person. But in her mind, that's, it's still not okay. I mean, it's something. Anyway, that's my soapbox, but go ahead. Okay.
No, I mean, I have many things to say based on what you said. The first thing that's just coming up for me, from your mom comment and from these other comments is, there's this a woman named Virgie Tovar who wrote the foreword of my book, and she is a expert on weight discrimination. She also, unlike me, has lived experience of being in a larger body and facing that discrimination. And she has said that weight discrimination is like the last standing socially acceptable form of discrimination. And I think it's very true, and the thing that breaks my heart and the reason why I'm really trying to talk to a lot of doctors and physicians and clinics is like the healthcare is kind of leads the way in that. We really do a lot of weight discrimination that is not helpful, that is actually causing harm. And so, I do think there's lots of opportunities that we have within medicine to really shift this narrative and make environments healing for everybody in all body sizes. And I think it's been really easy for me to feel overwhelmed by this resurgence of diet culture. I take care of patients and work really hard to try to get messages out to parents about ways in which we can support young people. And, you know, you can't turn on the TV without seeing a commercial for weight loss medication now, you know, and it's everywhere. And so, but the tell you the truth, the thing that gives me hope and the thing that makes me feel like, okay, we can keep pushing back on this narrative that we've all sort of grown up with, is working with young people and having teenagers self as kids is like, hold on, they deserve something better. They deserve to feel more freedom around and to not feel like they have to hide things and have this be this shameful thing, and to feel freedom in their body and trust in their choices around nutrition. So I do, you know, feel like we have an opportunity to serve this next generation and to, like, he didn't necessarily have to pass on this legacy that we've all grown up with.
And now I think we could take our commercial break, and then when we come back, we'll get the rest of the story. All right.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
What if your worst dreams aren't your enemy?
Falling, cheating, being chased, naked, drowning, losing teeth. What if I fail? What if something goes wrong?
I'm Teresa Chung, dream expert, best-selling author, and co-host of The Healing Power of Your Dreams. And in my latest title, Extreme Dreaming, I reveal a powerful truth. There are no bad dreams.
They feel so real, but that's so you remember them.
They're messages, signals, transformative gifts guiding you toward clarity.
Click on the Extreme Dreaming discount banner link on UK Health Radio homepage and learn to decode even your darkest dreams.
Extreme Dreaming.
Are you ready to listen?
The station that makes you feel good.
All right. So back to, so we were talking about your cousin. So you saw that growing up, and then where'd you go? Where'd you go, like, for college, or you want to?
Yeah. So I saw that growing up. I went to college. I will say, my uncle, I mean, this is a little bit of a tangent.
Fine. I like tangents.
Okay. My uncle had died of AIDS when I was in high school. And so I went to college and I was like, okay, I am going to, like, prevent AIDS. And I was, like, you know, handing out condoms at the bars and giving talks to the sororities and fraternities about safe sex. And so I went to medical school and I thought, I'm going to do reproductive health care and, like, probably women's health or OBGYN, because I really want to prevent STDs. And, you know,
right. Wait, where'd you go to college? I'm trying to picture you.
You were trying to picture me. I love it. I went to college at Miami University in Ohio.
Okay.
I'm going to get you all over the map here, because then I went to medical school at University of Virginia in Charlottesville.
Okay.
University of Virginia. And when I was in medical school, I learned more about adolescent medicine and this idea that, you know, when I was on my OBGYN rotation and I was seeing, like, okay, these are sort of people's health problems that we're trying to fix. Mm-hmm. But what if we worked more on the prevention side, and that pediatrics and adolescent medicine, I could kind of come at it from more of a preventative lens. And so I was pretty far out into my, like, applications to go into an OBGYN residency. And I said to my advisor, I think I maybe want to shift and do adolescent medicine, which is, you have to do pediatrics first. And she said to me, okay, Lauren, you won't be rich, but you'll be happy. And I was like, okay, I could live with that. Oh. She specifically said, you're not going to be able to shop at Saks. You could shop at TJ Maxx. And I was like, okay, that'll work. So I went to, did my pediatric residency at Brown in Providence, and first patient I took care of in the hospital, I was in the ICU, the pediatric ICU, and it was a college student who had an eating disorder, and she was in the intensive care unit for it. She had a heart rate in the 20s. She had kidney failure and liver failure, and her body was completely shutting down in like every organ system. And she ended up having to leave college, you know, drop out of school. And I was like, wow, I just could just saw the devastation of this disease. And, you know, I think the beautiful thing about taking care of adolescents is they're actually organically the healthiest age group. But they have all this morbidity and mortality that is preventable. So like organically, they're healthy, but they end up having diseases that like maybe we could help modify it. So, you know, I decided to do an adolescent medicine fellowship, which brought me to California to UCSF, because I really wanted to have an expertise in this of like, how do we really help, you know, this age group. There's only three age-based medical specialties. So there's neonatology for babies, gerontology for older adults, and then adolescent medicine is like specifically for this like 10 to 26 age group where there's just such complexity, you know, biologically, of course, but also socially and psychologically. And so I would describe it as the best kept secret of medicine because, you know, you have an opportunity to really help make shifts and really look at the whole picture and with young people and also with their families and their social experiences. That was a long winded.
Oh, I love it. I love it. Wow. I don't love. So what happened with that girl from Brown? Did you ever find out?
I did find out. The really bizarre thing was she ended up being somebody that I met when I was in California because she was from here. It was a really long struggle, a really, really long struggle. And, you know, it's actually the way
if her body was shutting down, like, obviously.
She does not have a quality of life that is, you know, can't really participate in anything. And, you know, I'll tell you how she actually first presented to medical care was she ended up, she was on this, like, played soccer. And her coach noticed that she was losing weight. Was like, you got to, so the family and the coach was like, okay, you got to make sure you're not losing so much weight. So you got to get weighed in. And she started to drink a lot of water because she wanted to way more. And so she ended up having a seizure from having had so much water. And so that was actually what initially brought her to care. And it's a long, devastating disease. Yeah. But people do die from this disease. Yeah. You know, it is unfortunately not a low mortality rate. It has the same mortality rate as childhood leukemia. So, you know, for young people, it says that's the second highest mortality rate of any mental health disease, second only to opiate use.
So what actually happens? Like someone says, I always think of poor Karen Carpenter. Somebody says you're fat and then you, like what actually happens in the disease that they can't see really what's going on? Like,
yeah, well, I'll say, you know, it's not even necessarily that somebody says you're fat. I mean, you know, there is often what I hear a lot of the stories I hear a lot about are I just tried to get healthier. I just wanted to make some healthy changes. And so I cut out sugar or I cut out meat or I cut out whatever, you know, stopped eating after 6 o'clock or whatever it is. And people just start, once the brain starts to get undernourished, it can just be a slippery slope. They actually did this study in the 1940s that wouldn't ever pass a regulatory board today, but it passed the regulatory board back in the 1940s, and it was called the Minnesota Starvation Study. And they did this study because they wanted to look at what were the impacts of starvation on prisoners of war. And so they took these young, healthy men in their like late teens, early 20s, and they cut their calories in half. So these young men with zero background with eating disorders or history of that, who were eating around 3,000 calories to begin with, they cut them down to about 1,500 to 1,800 calories, sort of this relative starved diet. And they kept them on them that for a number of months. And what they were expecting to see were the medical complications, right? They were expecting to see the weight loss and the impacts on their heart rate and the impacts on their electrolytes. But was a real surprise was the psychological impacts that they found that these men developed. So men who never had concerns about their body started to develop that. There were men who started to cut their food up into small little pieces, the same way that we see with eating people who struggle with eating disorders. They saw binging and purging that they never had, and more obsession around food. Three of the men actually left their career paths to join the food industry. And so what it taught us was that, wow, the brain, once the brain becomes malnourished, it can flip and it can switch into more of an eating disorder thought process that then becomes, you know, gets really obsessive, and then it becomes like a real slippery slope. And so I have never met a person who wants to have an eating disorder, and we don't necessarily know like who can cut out their sugar and do fine and who can cut out some of their food and develop this. You know, there's some of these biological vulnerabilities or genetic vulnerabilities that some people have. But what it's taught us is that there's this real physiologic impact from malnutrition. And so when we talk about the treatment, and when I'm working with parents who are like, my kid does not want to eat, you know, the first thing is like, we got to push the weight gain. Like, we first have to, before we get into the why or the what's going on in the thought process, it's like, how do we reverse the starvation?
So what about, like, I'm thinking of, you know, the wrestlers who would starve themselves, or, I was always on the ski team diet. It was eggs and grapefruits, but that was only 2 weeks. But like, you know, always doing something. And that was, I mean, they never were. I did a study in college. I had to take a science course. I was in the business school, but I had to take a science course. And so we did a project on, or whatever it was, on fad diets.
Yeah.
We went on them.
Wow.
And even maybe we lost a couple pounds, but we always gained more back. And it was like,
correct. Wow. Correct.
And that's fascinating. You know what I mean? Like, fascinating.
Completely. And that is not a like discipline problem. That's a biology. That's just the fact that your body wants to be at a healthy place.
But how many people, you know, talk about regular adolescents. Do they even know what their bodies need? I mean, is that, I would assume that's part of what you do is educate people, because there's so much confusion about, you know, you should eat meat, you shouldn't eat meat, you shouldn't eat gluten, you should eat gluten, rice is bad, potatoes are bad. Like, what, you know, like, how do people even know what's actually the right thing?
Like, yeah, and I think that is
water. I mean, everything is bad. You know, plastic bottles are bad. So like, what is there left? That's what I always say. What's left?
Totally. And it's constantly changing. So, you know, like the fad when I was young was like, oh, you got to get rid of fat.
Yeah.
Everything. And like, oh, fat is actually really important for us. So, you know, I do think the truth lies in the simplicity of it. And, you know, there's an incredible dietitian named Wendy Sterling who She's here in the Bay Area. She works with a lot of adolescents with eating disorders, but she calls it the ABCs, that nutrition has to be adequate, meaning it has to be enough. And so what I love what she does is she actually like shows a plate to parents, like a 10 inch plate, you know, like a restaurant size plate. Like that's what a meal should look like. So has to be adequate. The B is balanced. It has to be balanced, meaning we need protein, we need fat, and we need carbs. Adolescents actually like half their plate should be carbs. Like that is the fuel that your brain really needs. And if it's not getting carbs, it will break down muscle in order to make carbs, in order to make the glucose that the body really, really needs. So, you know, we have to make sure we're getting protein, we're getting fat, we're getting carbs. And the C is consistent. And the consistency is really important. So, you know, adolescents, you need to be eating breakfast and lunch and dinner and snacks in between. And one of the things that I had to add to my book was I added a section for the schools, because what I'll hear a lot from young people is like, nobody eats lunch. And I'm like, what do you mean nobody eats lunch? Your body, you know, you're expecting your brain to be paying attention, to be learning, you know, then you're going off to practice, to do your sport. Your body needs fuel. And we just have to really help normalize. Everybody has to eat lunch. Like we have to sit down. And this is where we get back to the modeling from parents, you know, of like, okay, as parents, we got to like show our kids, we got to sit down and eat and take that time to nourish ourselves.
Wow. You know, most people, you're right. They think about, well, I got to eat less. Like that's the thing. No one would ever say you got to eat more. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Yeah. But I went to this nutritionist, and she said, I probably slowed down my metabolism on one of these diets because I wasn't eating enough.
Completely. Completely.
So I had to start eating more. And it was like, ah, what are you, you know, to try to get it back going. And she said so many young girls do that because they go on 1,000 calorie diets and then they mess up their metabolism.
Absolutely. I mean, the body is so smart. And so it does everything it can to save itself. And so when its nutrition is decreased, it goes into a starvation state. And so it like a hibernation state. And so everything slows down. And so, you know, the heart rate slows down. I know we started talking about that patient that had a heart rate of 22. That's probably the most common reason I have to have people go to the hospital is because the heart rate slowed down. You know, their body temperature slows down. The way in which food moves through their GI tract slows down. So they'll feel like, oh, food is just sitting there. They won't poop anymore because, you know, they're just, things aren't moving. And the metabolism just really slows down. Their thyroid function slows down, which regulates a lot of the metabolism.
Yeah. Oh,
we have
how much how low do they have to go to get into this starvation mode?
See, you know, it's a real individualized thing. Yeah, it's hard to necessarily...
Like, what's your range?
You know, in terms of calories?
Yeah.
I mean, it depends. I mean, I am constantly shocked by, one, the individuality, where, like, I will see somebody who... you know, it's not the calories. It's the how much weight they've lost and how quickly they've lost it.
Okay.
So, which means, Hillary, like, it's not even like, you know, because one of the myths that I have to push against a lot is like, okay, this person doesn't, quote, look sick or look like they have an eating disorder because they're in a larger body. But it doesn't matter what weight they're presenting at. It's how restricted their nutrition has been and how quickly they've lost weight results in how sick they are. So people who've lost weight quickly end up being much sicker than somebody who maybe has lost less weight over a longer period of time. So the rapidity of the weight loss actually impacts both the psychological sickness, but also the medical sickness.
Wow. Okay, We need to go to our commercial break and then we'll come back. This is so interesting and I want to get to the solution. We need to get to the solution. I'm like, like it's scary. It's really scary what we're talking about, right? It's terrible.
Yeah.
All right. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving, it's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Somewhere on Earth, there are 4 acres that belong to you. You don't need to be there in person, only there in purpose, protecting it, defending it, keeping it alive. Because the world doesn't need more good intentions. It needs more meaningful actions. Register your interest at 4acresearth.com.
Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
And thank you as always to our sponsors. If people just had their fat, protein, and carbs as they're supposed to, would this even be an issue?
Well, it's a great question. You know, I would say a couple of things. First of all, you know, I think we have to name the fact that like bodies are not supposed to all be the same size, right? Like there is body diversity the same way that there's height diversity, the same way there's hair diversity, you know, there is diversity. It does not mean it's pathology if you're growing on a higher curve. That is often just the body composition that you have, where you have, you know, where muscle and bone weighs more than fat, and some bodies and some genetic backgrounds are just supposed to be at higher weight curves. And that does not mean it's bad or unhealthy. What becomes concerning in either direction is when people will gain a lot of weight where they'll kind of cross percentiles from where their body probably was intended to be, or they'll lose a lot of weight and, you know, cross percentiles from where their body was supposed to be. And when I ask people, like, what was going on at that time? You know, it is often not about the food. You know, it is like there are other elements. And I think for many people, food can become something that is a way to cope. And so it's like, oh, I was just really stressed. You know, COVID was not kind to eating disorders or to people who were struggling with feeling out of control around food, because food became something that you could control in our world that just felt really chaotic. So, you know, I think it is, there's more to the story with food than just, you know, a number.
Saying you're, yeah. So, yeah. And so it, yeah. And I guess, well, I guess the other side is if food is used to comfort you by a parent, here's a cookie, or whatever. That's what we would do. Regardless of whether we feel fatter, you know what I mean? That's another
game. Yeah. Speaking of comfort, I have to share one other study that I just love so much, because I think the challenge too is, you know, of course I'm a doctor, so I also think about like, what do we really mean with health? Because, you know, unfortunately what we've done a lot in medicine is we have conflated weight and health, and like made them seem like they're the same thing, when in fact they're really, we have to really decouple them and talk about like what actually is health. And they did a study in the 1970s where they wanted to see the impact of high-fat diets on cardiovascular health. And so they fed these rabbits these high saturated fat diets, and then they checked their cholesterol levels and wanted to look at their atherosclerosis and like what was happening to their hearts. And they found that there was one group of rabbits that was significantly healthier, like 60% healthier. And they were like, what's going on here? Because they're genetically identical and they're being fed the exact same thing. So like, why is this group of rabbits so healthy? And it turned out that that group of rabbits were assigned to a lab technician who was an animal lover. And she would hold the rabbits when she was feeding them, and she would pet them and she would talk to them. And it just helped us realize, like, gosh, there's so much more to health than like, what are you eating and what are you burning? It's like, oh, like the kindness and the stress is health. You know, so even when we're making these rules, like I'm bad if I ate that, like that's a adding the stress that does not need to get beneficial to us.
Yeah. Wow. Well, this is, I don't know if this relates, but I think it might. Like I've been in these spiritual courses and we're talking about the ego.
Yeah.
You're either in your personality, which is like the ego driven, or the spirit. And the ego doesn't want us to feel good. It wants us to have shame. It wants us to compare ourselves. It wants us to bring in the past to feel bad or worry about the future, which creates anxiety. And I forget what else. And I was talking to, I don't know who, I think she was the Akashic record person. I did a lot of interviews last week. I get confused, but she said the antidote to that is love. That the ego can't survive. It's almost like throwing water on the Wicked Witch of the West. Love. So when we're in the ego, you know, I'm thinking about the rabbits. That woman was loving those rabbits. She was bringing them to a higher vibration. I mean, I don't know if they think and compare themselves to their friends, but we do. You know, it's all about comparison, and social media is making it 1,000 times worse because they're all touched up and all that. You know what I mean?
Yeah. That resonates. I think that's, there's a lot to that.
Yeah. So I know maybe I'm on a tangent, but I'm going to throw this one in.
Yes.
I interviewed this woman who was a doctor and internist, and she went into cosmetic stuff, all sorts of stuff, skin grafts, all that. And I haven't had any, but I said to her at the very end of the interview, I said, you know, she was talking about elevating the planet and, you know, we were all love and we're all, you know, unconditionally loved just exactly as we are. I said, would there be a need for what you do?
Wow.
And what do you think she said?
She said no.
No.
Yeah.
Isn't that wild?
Yeah. Yeah.
So I don't know how it relates to the eating. You know, I said it's nutrition and all that, but when you said the thing about the rabbits and...
Totally.
I mean, why are we trying to be thin? We're trying to be okay in some made-up paradigm that was invented by God knows who back, I don't know, probably in the 60s maybe. And if we're not that, you know, it's like you get on the scale, I might as well go... jump off the deck. You know what I mean? Like, because it's some thing that was made up by somebody, some ideal that we're all trying to compare ourselves to that makes us feel bad, which is all ego-based.
Completely.
But we bought in that it's the truth.
Completely.
I mean, I think awareness is part of it. How does a fat kid, you know, let's say you have a little, I mean, now I have a belly. I'm like, I look at it with disgust. I'm still the same person. So how does a kid in a little rounder body ever feel like they're okay in this paradigm?
I don't know. Yeah. Well, I mean, I know. I mean, it's so hard. And I think we have to start by validating their experience, right? Because they are not coming to that like way where they're discriminated or they're critiquing themselves just happenstance. They're coming to that because they're absorbing that, because they're hearing that, because they're seeing that. They're like seeing one body type that's somehow morally elevated than another body type. And so then they're looking at themselves with criticism. So I think we have to start by validating, like, yeah, it makes sense that that's how you feel. And, you know,
I see. You're validating their feelings.
You're validating their feeling that's how what you've learned. And then one of the ways that I will help to navigate the conversation is talk to young people about, like, let's get to how do you want to feel? Because people will often come with this, you know, they'll have whatever sort of started the restriction of food. Maybe it was because they saw something, they heard something, they were told something. And in that, they also have this expectation that, like, if I lose that weight, I'm going to feel better about myself, about my mood is going to feel better, you know, and then they are quite disappointed to learn that, oh, like, weight loss doesn't treat eating disorders. Weight loss doesn't treat body dissatisfaction. Weight loss doesn't treat depression or social anxiety. Like, they're quite disappointed to learn, like, I actually feel worse in terms of my body. And that, you know, getting back to that starvation study, like, often the weight loss actually distorts the image even more. Wow. And so, you know, really trying to get clear about, like, how we want to feel. And I was talking to this incredibly wise adolescent recently who was completely recovered from her eating disorder. And I thought she was recovered based on her behaviors, her vital signs, her period was back, you know, her behaviors I'm hearing from her parents. But I said to her, like, how do you know you're better? Like, what in it tells you that you're better? And she said, I'm engaged again. Like, I am participating in my life again. And I was not for a really long time. Like, the lights were kind of off. And I was, like, going through the motions, but barely. And, like, that's really not how she wanted to feel. And so I think when she was like, this is actually how I want to feel. I want to have fun again. I want to feel joy. I want to be able to connect with people. And it kind of gets back to the ego, where when you're starved, when you're completely starved, like, there is really hard to connect with other people. Yeah. Because brain is like, you know, all I'm thinking about is, like, food. Like, you know, if you told me I was not going to have lunch today, I would be, like, spiraling. Like, yeah. You know, it's kind of all you're thinking about. You're not, like, really present and able to be connected.
Wow. I just keep thinking about those rabbits. Yeah.
Oh,
would more love, which is the antidote to the ego, would more love, how much of this could it eliminate?
I think a lot. I think a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. That's your next book. More love. Yeah.
I love that. Yeah. And I think young people can bring that message forward. You know, I put a lot of hope in the next generation because we have a lot of work to do.
Well, I have a quick question before, and we're going to have to wrap up soon.
Yes.
Like, I mean, I know I gave up apples because someone said apples were bad. I don't even know who said it. I gave up whatever. Do you know what I mean? I gave up so much because some rando who I don't even know who it was said it was bad. Where can people go to find out what's okay and what they should be doing in this very, very confusing world? Did you put that in your book, I hope? Huh. Or next book? Third book?
I put a lot of resources in there, okay, especially for parents, because they are like, how do I make sense of this health stuff? I'm really trying to get them guidance in terms of it, or not feel like we have to have all the answers, but there's tons of resources to learn more.
It's trusting them. Do you know what I mean? That they're not being paid for by the Dairy Association or the million, you know what I'm saying? Like, so anyway, okay. So you have resources. All right. What were you going to say? I'm sorry. And then
I was going to say, which might come as a surprise, but, like, I actually don't, I mean, I think there's nothing that is, we have to be so scared of in terms of nutrition, except things that are just, like, so packaged, you know, and I'm, like, thinking about the, you know, the protein powders and all these things. I'm like, why don't we just eat a turkey sandwich? Right. You know, my husband, I was in a fight with him because I'm like, why are you eating all that? Why are you drinking these protein powder? Like, he knows what I do. He knows how I talk. And I'm like, and he is a rock climber and he was listening to all these podcasts. We were talking about all this protein powder. And then he was like, you're going to laugh. I just heard about how like 60% of these protein powders have lead in them. And I'm like, so can we get back to the turkey sandwich we're talking about? And I think we have to like simplify it. But yeah. I know. So,
all right. So in the last minute, like I know people can get your book. I think every parent should. I think they should be in the schools for the teachers. That's what we're getting the word out. What do you want to say to leave people with?
Hope. It's exactly that. Is that just because we as adults have grown up and are absorbing this message that our bodies are supposed to be smaller and that we need to be critiquing whatever body part or part of our body that day is, you know, we're feeling not as beautiful as we can in it. That's not the message that we have to pass on to our young people, and that they do deserve something better. They do deserve to have real health and to not feel stigma based on their body. And I do think that there's lots of opportunities to shift the narrative so that young people can grow up and feel free and feel trust and feel love. Let's get it back to love. Can really feel love for themselves and for every body size, regardless of what it looks like.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
No, thank you. Thank you. I always get emotional, but thank you for the work you're doing. I'm sure, you know, it's something that's important and it's great. Just thank you for your courage, your commitment, and your love.
Thank you. Thank you for this conversation.
You're welcome.
Thank you for listening to the Getting Real with Hillary show on UK Health Radio. If today's conversation resonated with you, take a moment to reflect, share, or simply be with what you heard. Until next time, this is Hillary Burns, inviting you to stay curious, stay connected, and keep getting real.